whatever's given to you is just a first offer, or it's only the offer that that person's creativity allowed them to extend. And if you want something different or something more, just ask for it. And it's not just ask for it, like facilitate it, make it easier for people to offer it to you, you know.
Dr. Ella Elanazi is a tech bio investor at Ascension and holds a PhD in molecular genetics from Cambridge University. She describes herself as a recovering scientist with extreme FOMO. We talk about how being bombastic is the key to getting opportunities, why, contrary to popular belief, PhDs don't suck as investors, how to ask people to do things for you in a nice way, and what it's like being a brown woman in VC. I hope you enjoy. So last time we spoke, you mentioned this thing about being bombastic, and it's a bit of an interesting word. And you mentioned that it's one of those keys that you can aspire to be bombastic, or you can really embody it and get really far ahead. So can you explain what being bombastic means and how that can help you?
Of course. I think, you know, when I look back on everything I've done, I've been a bit shocked. Like, it's just out of body experience. I'm like, I can't believe, you know, 15 or 16 year old Ella was doing this, or, oh my God, who the hell was, who do I think I am? You know, but I think it's just really important for me just to go and do things and not think about it. And I think that's what being bombastic is kind of putting aside this worry about how it's being perceived, or like, you know, the ego element of it, and just doing stuff without thinking, right? And I think, you know, bombastic is a word, I don't know how I came across it, but it's just something that immediately comes to mind when I think about some of the decisions I've made. And really, like, if we're going to go deep into it, right, I think my first thought of someone being bombastic is my dad. So my dad is a fantastic guy, like, you know, super Khaliji, Middle Eastern guy. He'll haggle anything. And the one thing, like, you know, I'll never get over it. So my favorite story of him is something so basic, right? My dad has a package at home that pays for like internet, your TV, your calls, everything, right? And he pays less per month than I do for just internet, and we're on the same provider. And I was like, Dad, I can't, like, what are you doing? And all my dad does is he's just like, I'll just pick up the phone to these guys. And I say, you know, this is too expensive for me. Like, I've been a customer with you guys for 5 years. Can you guys make it cheaper? Or, like, I'm just going to go somewhere else. And it's interesting to me. Like, I thought he was being so bombastic. I was embarrassed. I'm like, Dad, put the phone down. This is a set price. Everyone's on the same thing. Just accept it. But my dad never accepts things presented as they are, ever. And I think he's been a great example of, like, being bombastic and, you know, never accepting the first offer you get or accepting the status quo. And that's really informed my whole life and everything I've ever done. You know, whatever's given to you is just a first offer, or it's only the offer that that person's creativity allowed them to extend. And if you want something different or something more, just ask for it. And it's not just ask for it, like facilitate it, make it easier for people to offer it to you, you know. So I think being bombastic is all of those things. It's, you know, trying to go after something that's not necessarily there, so you have to create it. It's a creativity and an audacity kind of fusion thing.
I wanted to chat about this debate I was talking about on the All In podcast, where they were discussing how helpful domain expertise is in investing in this space. And I think both Chamath and Friedberg made this point that they noticed that people or investors with a lot of domain expertise, a lot of scientific knowledge, although they're very helpful in an advisory capacity, people like that don't make good investment decisions. They get too caught up in the the trees and, you know, miss the forest kind of thing. What are your thoughts on this whole thing about domain expertise and whether that actually makes you a better investor or not?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be super careful about what I say. First of all, like, I have a lot of respect for them, and I had that podcast episode and it was great, but I was really disappointed when they said that. I just thought it's boring. It's boring. It's boring. It's uncreative. Like, just to say that, okay, academics, PhD scientists are this great monolith. They're all the same. They're super analytical. They need to perfect their art. They need to perfect their craft. And it's so far from the truth. Not only is it far from the truth, but it's almost like contradictory to their practices, right? You can't say that, you know, there are these exciting biotech companies that are pioneered by these brilliant professors and PhDs and postdocs, and they've come up with a great business idea, and then turn around and in the same breath say, you know, scientists don't understand business and they don't get how to make these great companies. Which one is it? Are they like people who just don't get it, or are they people who can understand it and who can praise it? There are different levels of PhDs and there are different levels of academics who have varying degrees of interest in being extremely academic or being entrepreneurial or being operational. And, you know, it's a great diversity within the scientific and the medical and the healthcare community. And just to say that, oh gosh, you know, they don't know how to make these decisions is just, I don't know how to respond to that. It's obviously not very true, but it's also something that bothers me in VC as well. Like, you know, as a general wider conversation, it's this idea of gatekeeping the identity of like what a VC can be and how it should look like. You know, you have brilliant IB kids coming into VC who can whip up a financial model, a discounted cash flow that could tell you the value of a company, great, which is good. You know, we need those people. But do they understand the tech? Do they understand the business? Do they understand the go-to-market? You know, there's a lot of questions around it. So I think, you know, having a team that's 100% PhDs investing is not great. Having a team that's 100%, you know, IB and financiers is not great. I think it's all about the diversity of the team and having these people come in. So I strongly disagree with it. I think some of the best investors I know have that scientific and deeply technical background. And I think the field is also waking up to this. You know, in VC, they say they want to see more operators because they value that operational experience when it comes to making investment decisions. And it's the same with science. You know, what happens if we take out the technical side of it and we just bring in, you know, these investors to look at a business model and to get external help on whether they think this is a good idea or a bad idea? I think you get companies that we know, like Theranos, for example, that goes all the way through it without ever getting, you know, a single penny from an actual technical investor who understands the space. We have to be careful about it. And I think there's a lot to say about having diversity and having a diverse team in it. So I disagree wholeheartedly with it. I think having PhDs are great. What do you think about it?
Well, I disagree with you. This quote about, you know, sometimes you need to be dumb to be smart. And another analogy that comes to mind is that when they research doctors who end up being patients and being seen in hospital, you'd think that they would be great at kind of advocating for themselves and getting really good care and making really good decisions, but they actually have worse outcomes than regular patients. And that could be for a whole lot of reasons. So I don't know. I think this thought that just knowledge itself being a good thing, I think it feels like it's intuitive, but it's not always correct. And then the second theme that maybe you can touch on this as well is that as I look at venture capital, I'm trying to just work out how much of it is a knowledge and intuition and thesis type thing, how much of it is like a network access, that kind of thing, and then how much of it is it just blind luck and gambling, essentially.
Well,
and I haven't really come to the bottom of that, to be honest.
I think it's because it's just so nuanced, right? So I think, you know, there's not one answer fits all. So when I say about how important it is to have people with domain knowledge in a VC or in investment decisions, it feels very critical in the early stages, because in the early stage of a funding life cycle, it's all about the product, right? So early stage VCs, there's not a lot of business modeling going on. Their financial forecasts are all touch and go. So really, you're just looking at the product and trying to understand, is the IP good enough? Does it make scientific sense? Is there actually a market for this? Is there a product market fit, which is what it's all about in the early stages? And I think that's when you need your technical experts. That's when you need people who are not, you know, I'm not saying we should pluck out a professor who's been in a research lab for 30 years, but you have entrepreneurial scientists, scientists who understand, you know, what product is needed right now and what kind of groups need, you know, what's an exciting business proposal out of their research lab and stuff like that. So I think in the early stages, technical expertise is extremely needed. I think myself, and I speak for myself here, I would not be comfortable or even think there's a need for me in the late stages of VC when it's all about growth. And that's when the IB people come in, the financiers. Now we need your models. Now we need to understand your market sizing, like properly bottom up, et cetera, et cetera. But I think in the early stages, you need it. So going back to your question about how much of VC is driven by different people from different backgrounds and how much of it is luck, I think it's a difficult one. At the beginning, there is definitely a need for having more scientific knowledge, especially in the tech buyer space, where understanding the product, understanding the science of it, and that helps you, but it's not enough to have a good idea to get it to blow up. And then in that pre-Series A, Series A space, the kind of like, you know, later stages, not exactly growth stage, at that point, you need a specific skill set, which is why I think you need to have diverse teams, where you have some product people, some operators, and a lot of financiers to try and figure out, okay, now that we know the product works, because they've passed all the regulatory approvals and passed all these big checkpoints and milestones, do we think that there's a market for it? What are the customers saying? And that's where the focus is more on the business side of things. And then the final stages is just the modeling to understand how it scales. So I think, you know, there's different profiles and different horses for different courses. And the second part of your question, I forgot. Is it about how much of it is luck?
Yeah, how much of this is, okay, this is investor is smart and they've got a good thesis and they can work out what's going on. And then how much is it just blind luck and we're like assessing, you know, the tickets of winning lottery people?
It's so difficult. It's so tricky. Like, you know, I've been in this space as an investor for the last 2 years, and I can't tell you if I'm a good investor because I haven't seen a lot of my companies that I've invested in raise their, well, they are currently raising their next round, but we'd have to track, you know, how many of these companies completely collapse, how many of them actually, you know, go on to raise big rounds and, you know, potentially exit. It's hard to kind of figure out how good you are as an investor. But I do think it's such, like, it's a job where you can't take it for granted and you can't rest on your laurels, and you're only as good as your last deal. So to say that someone has this Midas touch in investing, I think is just a fallacy. It doesn't exist. No one's so good that they can always pick up the best companies. You know, the people that I would have considered to be the most incredible investors because they've made bets that have blown up or turned into unicorns 2 years ago, those companies are like, you know, have been extremely devalued and they're no longer unicorns. So are they still a good investor or was it a hype deal? You know, so I think a lot of it's a tricky answer for me. I don't really have one for you that's straightforward. I think the only way you can really assess if an investor is good, or the way that I like to assess an investor, is to try and understand their due diligence process or their thought processes. And I think you can buy into that over buying into someone's track record or how much money they make out of it. Although ultimately that is the end goal, right? How much money you can make out. So there is an element of luck to it. A lot of people have looked this up and tried to understand it. There's a thing called the power rule, I don't know if you've heard about it, which is like assuming that, you know, most of your portfolio is really going to fail and only out of 10, like the top two or three companies, you know, are the ones that are the fund returners. So how much of it is luck? If you look at just the pure data and the stats, it seems like most of it is, so you have to hedge.
One of the things I've started to come to appreciate about investing is that a big part of it is being aware that the deal exists, and then secondly, having access to the deal. And I just wanted to ask how someone like yourself builds those networks, how you build that awareness, how you build that access, how you build those good relationships, how you maintain those relationships, because I would really struggle. I mean, do you just sit there and like fire off emails all day? Like how do you actually practically do that?
It's super hard. So when I joined the fund that I'm in right now, like it's just me on the investment team, right? And we were starting off from zero. No one really knew about the Life Fund. The Ascension has a big name in the market. It's one of the earliest, like the longest standing early stage pre-seed funds. But the Life Fund was very new. So a lot of it is about creating awareness. And lucky for us, like a lot of it happens online and on social media. Post-pandemic, you know, most people are getting a lot of their information from LinkedIn or like from webinars or whatever. So I think, you know, it's hard to do, but the way that I've gone about it is to approach it from a multimedia point of view. I'll go to a few conferences where I'm invited on panels, and I always hate going to these panels because I'm like, what am I going to say? Like, what, you know, what do you want to hear? But I think it's really good because it puts my face out there and it tells people, you know, in a room I'll be addressing like sometimes 100 different founders who will talk to each other, and that, they have their own network. It's a network effect. So I'll go to these panels and I'll try to go out there, conferences. I'll try to take interviews. I'll put out posts on LinkedIn every time I invest in a company in the knowledge that this is the profile of the company that I thought was so good that we invested in it. And I hope people who have similar profiles of other companies building in the space or whatever be like, ah, okay, she's invested in company X. We are similar, but we are company Y. Let me approach this person. So I think, you know, networking doesn't have to be, so it can be passive and it could be, you know, active. So the passive ones is me just putting myself out there as much as I can through social media, through conferences, going to specific areas, networking, going to specific dinners. And then there's the more, you know, active approaches, which is me going out to certain people that I think are brilliant in their field. So I'll go to certain professors or I'll talk to certain postdocs and I'm like, you know, you guys are this expert, you know, in an area, pancreatic cancer, and they're looking at these certain biomarkers, but they're academic. And I know, for example, that because they are the KOLs in this space, that anyone who's building would at some point try to contact them or try to get advice from them or whatever. And by building that network of academic partners, they could be like, oh, well, you know, 2 weeks ago, we spoke to the startup who's also building in this space. You should reach out to them. And that builds up your, you know, your source of deal flow. So deal flow can come through different networks, academic networks, through your friends in the industry as well, through passive means and social media. But also getting my own portfolio to work for me as well helps. So all the companies that I invest in, I try to make a really good, like, I try to be useful to them. And in being useful to them, I hope that they can go and tell their friends about it or can recommend them to try and talk to me. And that's been some of the best qualified deal flow that we have. How do you win deals? I think it's just being, it's being accessible and having the background I have. So, you know, we talk about what are the benefits of having the technical background. Some of these people have been building these products and these solutions for like 10, 15 years in their research labs, right? And they'll go to investors and they're like, right, cool, how much money? What's the margins? What's the market size? And it kind of dismisses a lot of what they've been building. And I have this absolute deep information anxiety. I want to know. Like ever since I left academia, I have this, you know, chip on my shoulder. Like, what am I missing? What's the latest paper that I can't see? So in my first calls, they're almost exclusively always about the products. So I want to know your research. How did you get into it? What did you find? What are your, you know, what are the big pain points? Like, show me your early data. Have you published? And just by having that kind of empathy with the founder and understanding the journey and trying to understand the core product, which is the science, has always helped me in building up my reputation with these founders, but also on winning the deals, showing a true, genuine interest in more than just the returns, which is important, you know. And that is something I definitely ask in like meeting two or three. But at the beginning, I just want to know the science, and that's really helpful. And that builds your reputation. These founders will go talk to other founders. You know, at the Life Fund, the big reputation that we've built over the years is that we do deep technical due diligence. And we ask questions other investors don't. And it's all about just trying to understand what these guys are building. Because, you know, they all graft in the labs. They do all this like crazy work. They're applying for grants to get, you know, this research done and conducted and finished. And then to have someone just be like, oh, okay, is it clinically approved? Fine. FDA regulated? Cool. Let's move on. Like, you know, that's the checkbox for them. But that is the product, and that's the star of the show. So I always try to go into it and understand it out of my own curiosity more than anything.
It sounds like you're hacking into that part of human nature where everyone really wants to be understood and appreciated.
It's like what they want operators, right? So you'll see a lot of really cool investors who are ex-Uber and ex-Google and stuff like that. Everyone wants an operator. They have startup experience. And what they're looking for is that empathy piece. Like, do you understand what I had to go through to get to where I am? And do you know and appreciate and understand the field enough to afford me the flexibility to do what I need to do to get this product onto the market? Because a lot of investors, you know, will see a product, it's semi-complete, and they'd be like, yeah, cool, let's get it out there. And there has to be a balance between how much time you commit to R&D and how much time you commit to actually commercializing. And understanding that balance between the two is very important. It's one I'm still trying to, like, you know, get my head around. And so I think, you know, a lot of these academic founders spin out companies, just want to make sure that they can continue doing what they're doing and not get hindered. So, yeah, it is a massive empathy piece, and it requires people to understand what it takes, you know, to get that product out there.
On a practical level, say you want to make some moves in the space of CAR T therapy or in large language models, or there's just a new area you want to go into. Practically, what would be the steps you would take to start building a network in that space or start getting some deal flow?
Me personally, I think I wouldn't go into a space unless I'm deeply passionate about it, because you need something to get you out of bed and you need something to get you deep in the trenches with these people. And the easiest way to get into these, you know, clubs, because they can be very exclusive, is to actually have a deep passion that you can pursue. So unless I was really into LLMs and stuff like that, I probably wouldn't try to go into it, because you need to be there in the trenches with these people, understanding, building, contributing, not just taking, right? So I personally wouldn't go where my passion isn't there. But for example, I could tell you one thing that I was passionate about that I got into, which is this space of AI drug discovery and drug design, all this stuff. Knowing that I had an interest in this space and wanting to learn more, what I basically did is try to research my own, like do my own research, desktop research, back to the lab. It's like PhD days. I read all the biggest articles. I reached out to the authors of those articles, asked them for like 15 minutes of their time. And I'm just like, hey, you know, most people who put something out there would love to talk to you about it, because they've spent a lot of time doing it as well. It's flattering to them, and to me, it's super educational. I reached out to a few of these key players in the AI drug discovery space, from startups to people who helped build them, to the coders, to the biologists. What are your struggles? What do you do? How can I, like, you know, at the same time, I try to give them something back, because you don't want to be just a massive taker. So I reached out to those people. In return, what do you need from me? Would you like connections to some VCs? Would you like me to share some of the findings that I have at the end of it? So I did this massive literature deep dive, a lot of interviews, and then I started talking to more founders in the space. So I had this absolute goal to speak to every single pre-seed and seed AI drug discovery company in the UK. I wanted to do it. And I had time on my hands, and I love talking to these founders. And I want to say that I covered 90% of them, the ones that have an electronic footprint on a footprint on the internet. And I just reached out to them. Show me your deck. This is what I'm interested in. I'm trying to build up, you know, some thought leadership pieces around it. Like, what's your struggles? What do you do? How are you different? And it took a lot of time, a lot of grafting, a lot of people being really suspicious as well. Like, what are you trying to do? But to get into a new space, you need to dedicate a lot of time, show passion, and just roll your sleeves up and get into it, really.
The one thing I struggle with in this space is there's this huge part of networking where you meet one person and they introduce you to two people, and then right, that effect snowballs. And that's a really good way to get integrated into networks. But the part I always struggle with, like in doing this podcast as well, is the ask at the end, as in asking them, can you introduce me to two people? I've not found a way in which I feel good about asking people to do that for me, basically. Is there a way in which, when you're doing these kinds of things, that you ask at the end, can you introduce me to two of your mates? Or like, how have you gone around that?
Just be like, it's going to sound terrible, just be bombastic. I think I hear what you're saying. And I definitely have that feeling where I never want to just be a taker. I don't want to take from someone and not give them something back. I think you just have to ask, and then ask them how you can be useful. Some people don't want anything in return. They just want to pay it forward because someone's helped them. So I think you just have to get out of your own headspace and, you know, just ask people. I found, especially in VC, like outside of VC, I was so intimidated coming in. It seemed to be like a, you know, a boys club. It was all closed off. How do I talk to people? Once I got in, I realized it was a bit of a different reality. If someone doesn't respond, it's not just because they hate me or they don't have, like, you know, they don't want to talk to me or they think I'm nobody. Most of the time it's because they're super busy or something's happening. So just leave it as it is, come back a few weeks later, be like, hey, listen, you know, I'm so sorry to bother you. I'm just checking in. Is everything okay? Like, just, you know, be more dynamic and be proactive about it. I think just asking is not hard to do. It's once you get over the hurdle in your brain about it, like being this difficult, imposing thing, it becomes easier. And let people decide for themselves whether they want to help you or not. So I think, you know, if they are busy, they'll let you know. But if you don't ask them, you'll never know. So you're probably missing out. The worst thing that could happen is just they say, no, sorry, or it's, I can't do it. And that's okay, you know, like for you, it's just a bit of like a bruise, right? Like a bit of a hit, like, oh shit. But once you drop the ego part of it, it's just, you know, okay, sure, I get it. It's probably like a really precious connection that you don't want to burn, or maybe it's something that you don't have the capacity to do right now. No worries. I'll still get to that person through someone else, right? And that's the way you need to think about it. Like, I don't know. I hope that helps.
Yeah. What's been your experience of being a brown woman in VC? And I'm really curious about pros and cons. Do you think there are any pros?
It's a good question. I think there's a lot of layers to it, right? Being a woman in VC and then being a woman of a certain ethnic minority in VC. I think it helps having the background that I do, right? Like, they're not taking a bet on someone, some, you know, brand, like, I want to say this without getting into trouble. There are a lot of mediocre investors that are in VC, a lot of them, right? And no one really asks about how they get in there. They're just in because, you know, they were like, whatever, they have a connection or they bought in or someone knows someone who's done a favor for them. Their networks really help them out, right? When they took a bet on me and when I got the position I got, I had to be better than the rest. I had to be completely excellent. You know, they were investing in a PhD student from Cambridge who was working at a pan-European accelerator. And I think that made their decision easier for them. I think it's really telling that I don't see a lot of mediocre, you know, ethnic minority investors, right? And I think that's where the inequality is. Being a woman who's brown in VC has become much more easier today in London. And I say this because there are phenomenal network groups for women in VCs, Asians in VCs, ethnic minorities in VCs. And there's like enough of us to create a body and to create a group where we band together and we talk about it. I think the hardest part of it has been getting into the VC part. But then once you're in, I haven't really faced as much discrimination for it. I think, you know, there have been certain moments where in a deal, for example, they'd want to speak to a partner and not to me, even though the, like, you know, the initial decision-making step has to like pass through me. I'm the first pass filter. So I come in and I tell this company, you know, sorry, it's not a fit for us. And they'll try to go over my head and go to my partner to like see if it's they can get around it. But I think that's less to do with the fact that I'm a woman and brown and more to do with just titles and seniority. I haven't really given it much thought, to be honest with you. And there are people who are fighting this good fight and thinking about it and trying to make it more equitable for us out there. And they have my full support. But for me, the way that I like to do it is just not to think about it too much because I don't want to dwell on it and have it be a blocker for me. Like in my head, I'm trying to be like, everything's mine. Everything's accessible. I can get whatever I want. And that has got me where I am in life. And I need to think about that more than I do thinking about the disadvantages. But there probably are there, and systemic racism is absolutely here. It's getting better, but it's, you know, it's one that I probably wouldn't be able to speak to you too much about.
Yeah, on your last point, I have a lot of agreement with that. I thought about how there is the true state of affairs. There's like the true model of the world. And then there's like having a useful model of the world or a useful frame in the world. And I think believing that people are going to discriminate against you, whilst it may or may not be true, I can't imagine it being useful in your own personal journey, or at least in my journey. I don't know if it's always useful. So I've definitely adopted that, I think.
Plays into it, right? Like I don't want to think about it because it negatively affects me. It makes me less confident in an interview. It makes me, you know, double, you know, think twice about their decision-making skills. And I'd rather like go about it. And if I get rejected, I'd be like, well, what did I do wrong? And, you know, like it probably is the racism part, but I won't let myself acknowledge it because it will affect the way that I go about certain things versus me trying to protect them or say that they're fair or whatever.
So last time we spoke, I wrote down this quote, which sounds really bad. Now I'm going to read it out, but it was from you. It was, no one gives you anything. You just have to take it. Like, what does that mean? Like, how do you do that?
It was a self-reflection piece for me. Like, you know, I think there's a lot of questions that I get from people who are now coming through, you know, the ranks, and they're like, all these PhDs who are looking at entrepreneurship, looking at VC. And they're like, oh, how did you get this? Or how did you get that? And I wish I could just tell them that the way that I got into this position or the way that I got into my internship at Amazon, even though I had zero of the entry requirements, was because I just applied and I got it and then they accepted it. Everything I've done has been an extremely proactive approach to getting to where I need to go. And there's no set path for it. And this is what I mean by just taking what you want. If you really have a passion to get into a space and you're doing it for the right reasons, you can't just wait for the perfect opportunity to open up or for someone to help you in or for a position to like, you know, magically appear, especially in VC where it's super hard and there's not a lot of like, you know, job opportunities because they're limited by fund sizes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. if you want something, you have to kind of create your own luck. So I remember when I was, you know, working at EIT Health, for example, the accelerator, one of the big things that I like to do was these due diligence deep dives, right? And one of the network people that we had in our network were just these VCs, and I loved what they were doing because it was all about trying to understand if a company works or it doesn't work. But I could never see a position open up or advertised that said, you know, we are looking for a healthcare or a life science investor. It just wouldn't come around. And there'd be like one a year or whatever. So if I waited for that opportunity to present itself and gone through the traditional route, I probably wouldn't be in VC. So what I did is I took the opportunity, like, you know, whatever the quote I said to you was. And the way I did it is I just reached out to all of these different funds. And it was never, I know how this world works. It's extremely transactional, right? It was never a knocking on their door being like, hi, do you have a job for me? Can you take me in? It was like a more creative approach that would get their attention. Because I know, you know, if you like, it's all about reverse engineering a problem, right? What are VCs' problem? Trying to source deals and understand if they're good or not, and then get into these deals, right? There's like three core problems of like a VC: finding a good deal, understanding the good deal, and then getting into it. So now that I know what the problems of VC are, I'm going to try and address it. And that was like going to be my long case study or my long interview. So I reached out to, you know, half of the UK / some of the European investors, just being like, oh, hi, not asking you for anything. I run an accelerator, I have some really cool deal flow. Let me just send it to you, no strings attached. And they were like, yeah, cool, send it to us. And then once I built that relationship with them, I reached out to a few and I'm like, hey, listen, you know, I could do my backgrounds in understanding breast cancers and metastasis, all this good stuff. Do you have anything in that space? I'm happy to DD it. I miss being in the research lab. I'll do it for you guys. No worries. And I got to do a few due diligences. So by the time that I built the relationship with these guys, I could be a bit more bombastic. I was like, hey, listen, I've given you guys these cool deals. You've seen what my due diligence looks like. What are you saying? You know, you've obviously made a few investments in this space. Bring someone on more full time. And that's kind of how these roles get created. They think and they create space for you. And that's an example of taking it, like trying to be useful to people, showing them who you are ahead of time, de-risking yourself as an investment for them. Effectively, you're pitching yourself like the startups do. And I think you have to be clever and creative about how you do it. So that's what I mean by taking it. It's creating your own opportunities and creating your own luck, which takes a lot of nerves. And you have to kind of accept it when people say no. Like, do you know how humiliating it was when I got into VC and then I started to meet all of these people that I used to bombard and like talk to all the time? And they'd be like, oh, Anna, your name is... And I'm like, don't worry about it. Like, hi, let me introduce myself again. I was just that pest that was like sending you deals and stuff. But I didn't mind because it got me to where I needed to get to. And I think one thing that people always love and always respect is someone who's trying to hustle. Right, I can tell a difference between someone who slips into the DM like, "What job are you? Do you have going? I want to work with you. Can you give me a job?" Right, versus someone who's like, "Hey, listen, I've started this student group looking into VC. It's something I'm so passionate about. You've done X, Y, and Z. I love what this is. Like, just give me 10 minutes of your time, or let's talk." And you have to respect that. Like, when you see that, it's so infectious. These people. And you want to be around exciting people, infectious people, people who are going to be like the next big thing in DC. So if that's who you are and that's what you want to do, you should have no worries going to these people because they respect it and they know a hustle when they see it.
One thing I forgot to mention, actually, I think something that you do really well with your conversation, and I'll just call it networking, but it's just like meeting and greeting people. And I thought this after the last time I spoke to you was, I think it's a part of human psychology where everyone is always the main character. Like, everyone has main character syndrome in their own head, yeah. Right? And I think there is something about the way you speak or when I've like interacted with you where you kind of make the other person feel like the main character and like they can do whatever they want. I remember speaking to you last time and you were like, you know, these are your goals right now, but you need to just 10x them. Like, I wouldn't be surprised in 2 years if you've done 100 times what you're saying you want to do right now. And I think that's another interesting part of this, just relationship building, but just thinking, having like the empathy to think about something from someone else's side. So I wonder if you've done that kind of consciously or whether it's just something you naturally do, but I think there is an element of just hyping someone else up a bit and making them kind of the main character rather than always being me, me, me.
I don't think I think of it like that. Maybe this is just like a personality trait or whatever, but first of all, I do think I'm like really up myself. Sometimes I have to check myself. I'm like, you're getting ahead of yourself. Relax, you know, it's not that. But I do think for me, it's an honest, like, intellectual curiosity, right? The reason that I love VC and where I am is the founders, right, that I'm meeting. These people are like creating novel ideas and they're coming up with brilliant, you know, concepts that I've never been, you know, thought of before. They're pioneering things that are super high risk. And for me, I'm just like, what drives you? How do you do it? There's like this kind of need to want to understand who they are and what they do. And you're one of them. You're creating this podcast that's very differentiated in a world that's very saturated. And I want to understand, you know, what's your motivation? What are you thinking? Brilliant people are so cool to be around. And you learn so much being around them. And I think that's really important for me. So, for example, you know, the biggest way that I've set aside my imposter syndrome is by realizing that it's not about me. I think imposter syndrome can sometimes be extremely self-serving. It's like saying, oh, you know, do I belong here? Instead of just thinking like that, I'm like, oh my God, I'm so lucky to be here, because even though I don't know anything about podcasts, you do. So tell me, what do you know? Teach me your things. Like, I just love it. I'm a massive information consumer. So what do you know? How do you know about it? And I just want to be this patchwork of all the interactions I have moving forward. So for me, it's not like, I don't think of it as like, oh, okay, I've spoken about myself enough. Let me ask you about yourself, which feels inorganic. For me, I think all of my interactions are always like, you're so cool as a person. What's your story? So I think, you know, you say it's hyping, which I didn't realize I was doing. I think you've built something really cool and I'm really privileged to be a part of it. But I just genuinely love it. I think it's really interesting. It beats, you know, like, you should see me around boring people. Around boring people, I wilt. I just lose the motivation and the will to live. It's just not my kind of scene. But when you meet people like you, it's easy for me to just, you know, want to learn more about you. Like, I think this is my main character syndrome, like, wanting, my main character energy is trying to like understand other people and get people and empower them and lift them up, because I think that's really cool. Like, I'm venture capital is a people business ultimately, and I love people.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, then please consider leaving a review. And by the way, all of these episodes are now available on Spotify and on YouTube in video format. Thanks for listening.